On December 13th, 1862, the Confederate General Robert E. Lee, watching his troops perform valiantly at the Battle of Fredericksburg, turned to a fellow general, James Longstreet, and exclaimed that it is well that war is so terrible, otherwise we should grow too fond of it. The historian Margaret Macmillan has spent much of her career thinking about war, why we fight wars, and why we cannot, or perhaps will not, stop fighting them. Her latest book, War, How Conflict Shaped Us, considers not only the destructive aspects, but the scientific, economic, social, and cultural importance of warfare. This coming Thursday, November 11th, many nations will observe Remembrance Day, the anniversary of the armistice which ended one war which was supposed to end all wars, but did not. This coming Thursday, as on all days, armed conflict will be a fact of life for millions of people in dozens of countries. This special episode of The Foreign Desk is an extended interview with Margaret Macmillan discussing the themes examined in her new book. Do we need war at some mystifying level? Is it something we are yet to grow out of? And even if we can't figure out how to stop it, what should we be learning from it? This is The Foreign Desk.
I don't think our biological nature makes us more predisposed to fight war, because think, we also have a strong instinct of self-preservation. You know, why would I want to go out and get myself killed? That's also a strong instinct. I think war is a very conscious human activity, and I think it's very shaped by our institutions, our cultures, our attitudes, and it requires a tremendous amount of organization and discipline.
You're listening to The Foreign Desk. I'm Andrew Muller. I'm joined for the entirety of this special episode by Margaret Macmillan, Engelsberg Chair in History and International Affairs at LSE Ideas, Professor of History at the University of Toronto, Emeritus Professor of International History at Oxford University, and the author of several previous books, including Peacemakers, Nixon in China, The Uses and Abuses of History, and The War That Ended Peace. Margaret, welcome to The Foreign Desk. We are, of course, broadcasting this shortly before Remembrance Day, November 11th. Here in the UK and in a lot of other Commonwealth realms, a culture war is now fought annually at this time of year over the righteousness or otherwise of wearing the poppy. In the time I've lived in the UK, I've seen this ritual develop from this fairly modest gesture of remembrance into something which has become, at least to my mind, kind of forced, even possibly somewhat kitsch. How do you feel about the poppy now?
I think I'm probably with you. I mean, we seem to like culture wars as a species, and this is nothing new. I mean, we've had culture wars for ages over how to remember wars, and how we think about past wars changes, and it changes very much because of what's happening in the present. And I think the pressure to remember the First World War and perhaps remember the Second World War comes partly from the fact that Britain is looking for its place in the world. And so that looking at the past, looking at what are seen as the great moments of the past, perhaps become more important. And I agree with you. I mean, I think remembering those who died in past wars should be an individual act. We come together to do it, but it should be a matter of choice. And I think we should remember them, but I think it shouldn't be something that is forced on us. I think, you know, the compulsion to wear the poppy seems to me is not the right way to try and remember those who died in wars.
A lot of your new book is concerned with how we should remember war and how we should think about war. And I guess that's a good place to come in, because one thing that you are very clear on is that whatever we do think about war, we should actually think about it.
I think we should, and it's not just because I write books on it, but I think war has been such an enormously important force in human history and has played such a part in shaping our society, shaping our values, even shaping our arts, that we need to think about it. And I think also we need to think about war because it's present in the world, and the danger of war is something that is often present in the world. Trotsky, the Russian revolutionary, once said, and I think he said it very well, you may not be interested in war, but war is interested in you.
I mean, it's a really basic question, the one about why humans fight wars. It's one of the first things that occurs to any inquisitive child as they start to understand that there is perhaps right and wrong and justice and injustice, that question of why do we fight wars if they're so terrible. I occasionally find myself wondering, is there a part of us that just enjoys it?
I think we have very complicated attitudes towards war. You talked about children and their attitudes towards war. I mean, they find it horrific. They say, why do people fight? but they play war games. You see a little group of children, they tend to organize themselves into group, and they're not hurting each other, but they often fight pretend battles. And I think that reflects something of the attitudes of adults, that we are greatly horrified by war, but we also have a fascination with it. I mean, if you go to any bookshop and you look for books on war in the history section, there are hundreds of them. Look for books on peace, and it's a much shorter section. And so I think there is a sort of fascination with war, partly, I think, also because people do awful things in wars, but they also do very brave and heroic things in wars. And so it's complicated, isn't it? War brings out the worst in us, but it also can bring out the best in us.
On that thought of the vast acreage of books about war, that you're quite right, that you will see when you go into any bookshop, how daunting does that make sitting down to write another contribution to those bookshelves?
It makes it absolutely terrifying. I did something very bold. I mean, perhaps because I'm getting on, I'm sort of getting reckless as I get older. But I thought I will write a book about aspects of war and try and think about war. And I thought as I was writing, there are going to be people who know a lot more than me about this. And they're going to say, you got that particular gun wrong. You got that particular battle wrong. That happens. But I think war and its impact on our societies and the possibility of war is just so important that I think we all can talk about it.
Again, in terms of looking at its appeal, is there also the thing that for the people participating in it, certainly as combatants at least, it provides a sense of purpose that is very difficult to find in any other arena?
I think you've put your finger on something that is very important. And I think one of the reasons why people who are demobilized after a war sometimes have trouble in readapting to civilian life is because they have enjoyed an intense camaraderie in war. I mean, not all wars and not all units in wars, but I've read enough memoirs and talked to enough people who fought in wars. So, you know, there is something about it. You know that the person next to you is prepared to die for you. That doesn't happen much in civilian life, but it's that camaraderie and it's that intensity. I mean, again, I've talked, and also a lot of the war memoirs say it, that when you feel you might die at any moment, everything's enormously intense. The colors are brighter, the sounds are stronger, your senses are awake. I mean, you don't want to live like that. But it is a moment that very few of us, I think, experience in peacetime. A lot of the war memoirs don't go on about how awful war was. They talk about the good times. And that says to me something about how people think and react towards war.
Is there always going to be, though, a fundamental gap between those who have and who haven't? And perhaps in that division lies the difficulty.
Yes, I think the difficulty is in trying to explain it. How do you explain something so monstrous and so enveloping in something that arouses such intense emotions? I mean, some of our best writers and artists have tried to do it from Homer onwards, and not just in Western cultures, but in cultures around the world. I mean, the drawings, the pictures, the music, the attempts to explain. But it remains a mystery, I think. Tim O'Brien, who wrote what I think is one of the best novels and has written other ones about the Vietnam War, said, as soon as you try and explain it, it somehow escapes you. You know, when you try and put into words these extraordinary emotions, but we keep trying to do it. And I think one of the frustrations you often get in the literature, the memoirs, for example, All Quiet on the Western Front, that great novel, when the protagonist and the German soldier from the First World War goes home, he finds the civilians incomprehensible and they don't seem to have any sense what it's really like, but he can't tell them. And so I think to get at the experience of war is probably, as you say, impossible, but we're going to keep trying to do it because it is such an important and intense experience and affects people so much.
It's another thing that I think occurs from any study of military history is that it almost never works out like it's supposed to. I know you cite that wisdom attributed to Moltke that no plan survives contact with the enemy, which I think later was repurposed by Mike Tyson as everyone's got a plan until they get smacked in the mouth. Has there ever been a war that has actually worked as advertised, that just went like clockwork, did everything it was supposed to do, no more and no less?
Wars never go like clockwork, and von Clausewitz, the great German military theorist, talked about something he called friction. The Americans call it Murphy's Law. What can go wrong will go wrong. And Clausewitz said, you know, you have these wonderful plans. As soon as you get people marching, someone will fall over, a horse will go lame, a bridge will be washed away, whatever. Things will go wrong. But those planning wars, if they're sensible, will allow for that. They will develop an overall strategy and they will have a plan. I mean, Nelson's overall strategy in the Battle of Trafalgar was sort of basically every ship will try and get alongside the enemy. I mean, that was his main order. And the order, of course, was then to sink the enemy if you got alongside them. But he didn't put down detailed plans because he knew that so many things influence what happens in a war. But I think there are wars that have achieved their purposes. The limited wars of the 18th century, when someone went to war to get a bit of land and got that bit of land. I mean, that can happen. You can achieve your goals. But too often we see wars where they start out fighting without a very clear idea of what they want and without a very clear idea of how to end it. I mean, one of the problems of the NATO invasion and occupation of Afghanistan, for example, was that they started out with the intention of overthrowing the Taliban and punishing Al-Qaeda, which they did. And then their goals just kept expanding, and they had no clear definition of what victory was, which I think is one of the reasons that it came to grief in the end, and the NATO forces led by the United States decided to pull out. And so I think those who start wars should always be aware that the war might run out of control, that they might not get what they want. The interesting thing also is that those who start wars sometimes don't know much about war. And I've talked to a number of people who've actually been involved in making the decisions. And in my experience, the military are much more cautious, because they know the difficulties of war and they know what can go wrong. And it's often civilians who've never fought in a war who can be more hawk-like. And the military are the ones who say, no, wait a minute, it's not that easy.
I mean, those civilian governments that we're referring to here, how much in the post-World War II period are they still seduced by the fact that World War II gives us, by which I mean the West, the spectre of the one unarguably good war? And we can say it, I think, quite correctly, that there was a moment where good confronted evil and good triumphed. Are we still seeing Western governments who want a bit of that for themselves?
Well, I think we're often influenced by what happened in the last war or what happened in the last political campaign or what happened in the last financial crash. You know, our memories help to shape the way in which we see the present and what we decide. And I think the danger always is, as the past recedes, we tend to impose a rather simple picture on it. And it is true that the Second World War, I think most of us would agree, the right side won, and it was a triumph of good over evil. But it's more complicated than that, of course, because the Western allies were allied to one of the greatest tyrannies of history in the shape of Stalin's Russia. There were things that happened in the Second World War which we have tended to gloss over, the mass bombing of Germany, which in the end doesn't seem to have served much military purpose, but caused, of course, tremendous loss of civilian life and destruction. I think more recently what's going to happen, I think the American military, among others, are going to spend a lot of time looking at Iraq and Afghanistan, and it will be interesting to see what conclusions they draw from that.
Is there a clear way to explain why militaries don't learn from their mistakes, or why it takes them so long to learn from their mistakes? And obviously the comparisons between Afghanistan and Vietnam are imperfect, because any such comparison is going to be, but there was an amount of overlap. You have this awesome military superpower struggling for years and failing to win a war against a relatively lightly armed guerrilla militia.
I think the military, in fact, do learn from the last war, and they try to learn from it. But it's very difficult to change the military, because you invested in all these weapons, you've invested in certain ways of doing things, and just the sheer process of change can take a long time. I think also what can happen is the military and their civilian counterparts will often decide that we will never fight another war like the last one. And so after Vietnam, the American military and the American political leaders said, no more Vietnams. We're not going to fight a counterinsurgency war. In fact, they gave up counterinsurgency training and the best manual on counterinsurgency war, which is what they had been partly fighting in Vietnam, was allowed to go out of print. Then when they got into trouble in Iraq, that suddenly came back into print again, and they suddenly began to look at it. I think often it's the civilians who don't learn from the last war. I think there's a danger that the more powerful you are, and I think the British Empire and its leaders had it in the 19th and early 20th centuries when Britain dominated the world, and I think it affected the Americans as well in the Cold War and immediately afterwards, that when you're very powerful and you have overwhelming force and technology, you have the edge over everyone else in the world, you think that's going to be enough, and you think everyone else in the world is going to recognize it. And what if they don't? You know, the Vietnamese didn't recognize it, even though they took terrible losses. The Taliban fighters, ISIS fighters, Al-Qaeda fighters didn't recognize the great power of the United States and its allies when perhaps they should have done, but they were prepared to stick it out. So, you know, it's how you learn and what you learn and who's doing the learning. All of these things matter.
Well, on that note, do you think we have got any better as a species, both in terms of just our thinking or the political structures we've built at not having wars, at constructing ways to avoid them?
Depends which day you ask me. Sometimes I think we have got better. I think we have learned. Having international organizations, permanent international organizations, I think does help. If only, and it's not if only, but if only because they provide places where people can speak. but they also provide services. I mean, the UN, for example, and its allied agencies increasingly is going into war-torn countries after a war is over and helping to rebuild. And this seems to me a very useful function because it may help to remove the causes of future war. And so I think the more we can build international organizations, the better. The problem always is that no international organization is going to be any better than the members. And if the stronger members don't support it or working against each other, then it's going to find it hard. But I think we are conscious increasingly that we live on one planet. Climate change and COVID, I think pandemics have helped us to realize that. And I think we're also beginning to realize that preparations for war are still going on. Weapons are still being made more powerful and more deadly. And that poses a real problem for all of us because there are now weapons so deadly that basically they could wipe out everyone and stockpiled enough that they could wipe out everyone on Earth. And so I think, you know, that public opinion can do a certain amount and international organizations can do a certain amount. But as I say, it depends which day you ask me, because there are other times when I look at, say, the preparations going on and the rhetoric between the United States and China, and I think, what are they playing at?
Does it strike you that where the United States and China are concerned, that the principle of deterrence will hold either or both back? Because this, of course, was what the Cold War was balanced on, at least where the United States and the Soviet Union and direct conflict between them were concerned.
Deterrence can work. It always worries me slightly because deterrence only works if the other side believes you're going to do it. And the danger always is that you think I have to really show I'm going to do it by doing something. And yes, it's true that there was a nuclear balance, mutually assured destruction, or MAD in that wonderful acronym during the Cold War. But we now know how close we came to that balance just breaking down into outright war. I mean, there were times, mistakes, accidents, mutual misassumptions when the two sides were very close to launching. And so deterrence, I think, is only part of how you prevent war. I think what's very important too is reassurance of the other side, communication with the other side. And that's what worries me when the rhetoric starts, when each side starts being hostile to the other. It makes it more difficult for that sort of long-term building of relationships.
I mean, it's a recurring motif of the book and it's a recurring motif of history, this idea that military might and the willingness to use it, it's a symbol of national prestige, an indicator of national vigour, etc. Do you think that's still as true as it might have been? Because it certainly struck me rather bleakly during the United States' abandonment of Afghanistan that President Biden had calculated that amid the sort of extraordinary hurly-burly of the 21st century news cycle, 2-3 weeks later, everyone will have moved on to something else. No one was really all that bothered about Afghanistan anyway. And by the time we get to the midterms, no one will even be thinking about it.
He may be right. And actually, the polls in the US say a lot of Americans don't care about being, you know, the great power in the world anymore. But it's what others are thinking. I mean, I think Putin probably drank a celebratory glass of vodka in the Kremlin when the United States pulled out. And prestige and credibility do matter internationally, and nations do take it very seriously. I mean, not all nations value military power or want to be great in military powers, and it can change. But I think there still are nations in the world which value their military strength greatly. Russia has large military parades every year in Red Square, and in China, they have big military parades every year in Tiananmen Square. So, you know, I think certain nations at certain times will value their military and their military prowess.
Are you heartened, perhaps, by the idea that technology will make the human involvement in warfare perhaps less necessary than it presently is? Could we end up rendering war more or less irrelevant by taking humans out of it?
I think war will be with us. We may render war very different among nations that are advanced technologically, but the wars that are happening around the world at the moment are mostly not being fought with high-tech weapons. I mean, they're being fought with old rifles, with machetes, with hose. That's, I'm afraid, going to continue because they're very difficult to stop. I'm thinking of the war in Ethiopia at the moment or the wars in Somalia, for example. But I think we are moving where the human factor is being taken out, and that, I think, might have dangers. I can see it's going to happen and I can see why it's attractive. But the danger is, first of all, that those who are ordering the killing are more and more detached from it. So it may just become like a video game. The military say this isn't so, but I think there is a danger that someone can rain down destruction on a village halfway around the world. What do they care? You know, they're not going to be there to see what's happened. They may seek photographs of it. So I think that's a danger, that we get detached from the consequences of using weapons. The other danger, of course, is with autonomous weapon systems guided by artificial intelligence. At what point do they just go off and do their thing and we have no say over it? And that, I think, is a big question we're all going to have to face. I mean, if you get weapons that will decide, or systems rather, that will decide when the time has come to launch or when a war is starting, and there's no way of stopping them, or if you get weapon systems that decide it is perfectly okay to destroy every school in a certain region and every hospital, and there's no way of stopping them, what does that mean for humanity? I mean, I think we're facing really big questions now about how to control some of these new systems that are coming on stream.
I want to go back to something you were saying earlier about the way that we think about war and talk about war and certainly think about it. And you're right that certainly in retrospect, we do tend to look at these things as a fairly cartoonish dichotomy. There were good guys on one side and there were bad guys on always the other side because we're always the good guys. How can we teach it better? I guess maybe from an early stage in schools, getting people to think about it as not a comic book.
It's a very good question. Of course, we all worry about how we teach our young, and we can't teach them everything. You know, we can't overload the school curriculum. But what I would like to see is war being treated as something that is part of the human experience and part of human history, not as a separate subject which you don't touch at all in schools, or if you touch, it's only in a sort of little box of its own. I mean, that's been happening a bit in universities where war studies tend to be in different departments. And I think I would like to see the study of war integrated into human history, just as vast economic changes like the Industrial Revolution are integrated into our understanding of the past. I think, you know, all we can do is make children aware that the past is a complicated and messy business and give them some sense of what happened. I mean, I think understanding the order in which things happened is very important. I mean, I've occasionally had students who said, "What? There was a First World War?" And I said, "Yes, there was." You know, they don't always know that there was a chronology here. And so I think that's important. I mean, look, I think history is very important because I think all of it, not just the history of war, but history of women, history of classes, history of imperialism, all of it helps to explain the world we're in and helps to explain our own societies. And so, of course, I think the more we teach it, the more people understand it, the better.
It's a question I'm always fond of asking in places where there is or has been a conflict, the moment at which people realized, hang on, this is actually happening. And what they tell me is usually some variant on, we didn't think this could possibly happen until it did.
It's very true. I mean, I think it's human nature. I mean, perhaps we tend to be optimistic. I mean, I've been reflecting a lot, and I suspect you have as well, on how we adapted to COVID. And I remember being in the UK in March 2020, I think it was. And suddenly, in about a week, we went from fairly normal society to theaters closing, people wearing masks. You couldn't buy a mask for love or money. And suddenly, travel got very difficult. Yet we adapted and we found ourselves in a very different world. And looking back, I mean, I think we're all quite surprised at how quickly we adapted and how quickly we got used to it. And how now, you know, I go to a restaurant in Toronto, I have to show my vaccination certificate. It doesn't strike me as odd at all. It's just what you do.
That leads into a point that you do make frequently in the book, the idea of war and conflict as a catalyst of innovation. And a lot of great inventions and wonderful things that we have come to rely on and take for granted did come about, whether advertently or otherwise, as a consequence of conflict. Have we figured out any other way than war to advance technology and advance ideas as quickly? Is that part of our problem, that at some level, whether we understand it or not, we kind of need it? The creative destruction idea, I guess.
Yeah, I sometimes think so. I mean, it sometimes takes a great crisis to oblige us to do things that we sort of knew we should be doing anyway. And it needn't be a war. It could be an economic crash like the one in 2008, when governments not only bailed out failing companies and financial institutions, but actually put in place some measures that would try and prevent this happening again, which a lot of people have been saying they needed anyway. And I think with COVID, I mean, people have been warning for ages in the medical profession that we were going to get another pandemic. It was just a matter of time. And we sort of knew it, but we didn't do much about it. Governments set up offices, which they then didn't fund properly, or they abolished them after a few years. And so it seems to be something about human nature and human society that it takes a big crisis for us to focus our attention. And then we will do things which we would have said absolutely impossible a few months before. I mean, you know, I was again thinking back to the start of the pandemic. If you had said to me, even before it started, governments will be spending an enormous amount of money to prop the economy up, to support people who can't go into work, I would have said, no government's going to do that. I mean, you know, they won't take on that load of debt. Well, look what happened. So I think our capacity to mobilize ourselves tends to be triggered by a major crisis.
I wanted to ask as well about your personal interest in the subject, because this is certainly very far from the first book you've written on or about or around war. So where did your personal interest in it come from? And I guess attached to that, do you think that female historians write about war or approach war differently from men?
Let me answer the second one first. I'm not sure. I think women tend, but this is a wild generalization, you can always find exceptions, we tend to be quite good at reading people and we tend to be quite interested in people. Not that many male historians aren't as well, but I think women always like this sense of who are these people? What are they thinking? Why are they doing it? And so perhaps we approach war slightly differently in that. What are the soldiers thinking? Why are they doing it? What are their emotions? I don't know. It's difficult to say because until recently, not that many women wrote about war. It tended to be very much a male preserve. And now there are a lot of really interesting young women historians who are beginning to make their marks. And so we'll see how it changes. As far as my own personal interest goes, I think it was partly where and when I grew up. I was born just at the end of the Second World War. And so when I sort of began to take note of the world around me, there was a lot of talk about the war. My father had been in it. I didn't see him for the first 2 years of my life because he was at sea. And that was typical of a lot of my friends. One of my uncles was a Lancaster bomber pilot. Another one was at sea. You know, so there were sort of people around. And we had bits of old uniform that we played dress up in. And both my grandfathers were in the First World War. So we just heard about wars. And I lived through the Cold War. And that was very much a fact. And so I think it just seemed to me an interesting subject and something that was sort of very much in the air. It was just there. And so perhaps it was a mixture of personal and the times that I became so interested in war.
We were talking earlier about how war is, you know, inextricably bound up with every other aspect of human society. But just wondering about sport in particular, which George Orwell described famously as war minus the shooting. Do you see that as any kind of proxy for conflict? Is that our way of getting out the same animuses that we might otherwise do on the battlefield?
Well, I sometimes think so. You know, when you see organized supporters at football matches chanting in unison, and when you see sometimes the vituperation and hatred that is thrown at the other team, and the Olympics, the modern Olympics was started by Baron de Corbetan before the First World War as a substitute for war. He wanted to bring young people together and he didn't want any national flags. He didn't want any nationalism. Well, that lasted, I think, for the first Olympics only. And you look at the Olympics now and it's all about which nation is stronger and the medal tables and the flag waving. So, yes, I think in a way Olympics have become, I think Orwell's right, they've become a substitute for war or a type of war. Thankfully, without the weapons, but they certainly arouse, it seems to me, the same sorts of passions.
Margaret, just lastly, I guess to wrap things up with the big question behind all the small questions we've tried to answer so far, is war just part of human nature?
I don't think it's a fundamental part of human nature. I mean, there's a huge debate about this, as you can imagine. Is it biology and evolution that has left us with these warlike tendencies? But I think war is highly organized. You know, it's a conscious activity. We don't just rush into a battlefield because we feel like it, because we have violent impulses. In fact, I was talking to a group of military in Washington, and I said, would you want a recruit who just wanted to get out there and kill people? And they said, probably not. We want someone who can be disciplined and trained, and we want someone who'll be calculating. And so I don't think our biological nature makes us more predisposed to fight war, because think we also have a strong instinct of self-preservation. You know, why would I want to go out and get myself killed? That's also a strong instinct. I think war is a very conscious human activity, and I think it's very shaped by our institutions, our cultures, our attitudes, and it requires a tremendous amount of organization and discipline.
Margaret McMillan, thank you very much for joining us. Margaret's new book, War: How Conflict Shaped Us, is available now. That's it for this episode of The Foreign Desk. We'll be back next week, and look out for The Foreign Desk Explainer, available every Wednesday. Do also keep an eye and an ear out for this week's installment of The Big Interview, in which I speak to the former President of Colombia and Nobel Peace Laureate, Juan Manuel Santos. The Foreign Desk was produced and edited by Christy Evans, Jack Dewars, and Emma Searle. Emma also produced this week's Foreign Desk Explainer. From me, Andrew Muller, thanks very much for listening. Until next time, goodbye.